Good morning. It's too early for all this frivolity here. We got Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. And I drug in here on the 2nd of February of 57. Kind of liked it, and so I just decided to stay. That is good to see you this morning. And you look pretty decent for a crowd that just got up. I don't want to start out with any negativity at all, but I'm not the greatest hero of emotional sobriety in the world. And way back when I came in, AA was just sort of getting to be well known, and catching on that it seemed like a good idea. And we started proliferating, we just meaning the world in general, started proliferating a lot of things that were AA and beyond. And sobriety and beyond, AA second level, you know, there was just a whole bunch of spinoff kind of deals about how to do it in a different language. And that always was kind of troubling to me, that you know, what we had was some principles that were well established and well proven, and then we try to embellish it with a whole bunch of new language. And so, in some ways, you know, that I think there's a possibility of moving into that in this kind of a topic, where we start seeing beyond. So, what I want to do is deal a bit with that. Now, Bill didn't write prolifically about that. He wrote one letter to a guy, and then it turned up getting published in the Grapevine. You know, he turned it into the Grapevine. But that's the only writing there ever was about that. You know, there wasn't any kind of a real research and development project, anything like that. It just sort of caught on. And it's an idea that never has really flourished, but it's always been there. And so want to talk a little bit about that, and then keep in mind one thing. I was just looking for a 12 and 12, and I couldn't find one. So you'll keep me from reciting it. I was going to show off and recite it, but you keep me from embarrassing myself if you do that. Yeah. Can you turn to the first page? Oh, here you are. God, I'm flooded with books. I'll take one. I'm away from here, for God's sake. I got work to do. There's a place right in the front part of this book, I think. Where, somebody that's a real book technician, tell me where that is. Here it is. I won't even have to wake up the expert now. I found it myself. But this, to me, is a kind of a banner that needs to go over the dialogue we'll have here this morning. It says, AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink. can expel the obsession to drink. I lost my place. And enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. Now, it's a great promise. That number one, it'll expel that thing. It means it's gone. That obsession to drink is gone. And then will enable the sufferer, to become happily and usefully whole. And I can testify that that's absolutely true. I've had more fun since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous than a human ought to be allowed to have. And so those few little words to me are awfully important in terms of what our program is about. It's not about pain and suffering. It's about being free. And it's about learning how to enjoy life in new ways. And ironically, most of it comes when we forget ourselves and start focusing on others, is where that starts to happen in a magical kind of a way. And I had the privilege of meeting Bill one time. We didn't go fishing together or anything like that. I just met him in an intimate little gathering in Toronto in 65. And only 20,000 of us. It's me and Bill and 20,000 more. And I couldn't afford it, but I went there anyway, even though I couldn't afford it, because I wanted to meet that guy. Now, I mean, he was a guy that was significant in my new life. And I just didn't want to tell him anything. Didn't want to touch the flesh or anything like that. I did, but that wasn't what I was after. I just wanted to be in the presence, make sure he's really there, that he wasn't just some mysterious writer, ghost writer somewhere. And so I had a chance to do that. He was like the Energizer Bunny. He was all over Toronto, so I saw him a lot, but he was always a blur. He was just running from one thing to another. And then at one point we had a tradition meeting. Well, you won't believe it, but it was a pretty small group. I don't know what it is. You mention traditions, it's like a fire drill, you know. It takes off. I find them probably the most stimulating principles in our program. That was a great opportunity. That was the most intimate contact I had with Bill. It was just probably 30 of us in a room. And he started talking about his vision and about traditions and about this fellowship in a very folksy kind of just down-to-earth way. And I really didn't want to tell him anything. Just shook hands with him, thanked him, and that was it. But what a great experience. And at that meeting, if any of you were the last one in Toronto, the thing I really highlighted in what I had to say there was in 65, Bill introduced the Declaration of Responsibility. That's pretty much part and parcel of AA today. You know, that I am responsible. When anyone, anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA to be there. And for that, I am responsible. Not y'all, me. I am responsible. And if every one of us feels like that, AA becomes a very vibrant, a very living kind of a process that does indeed make people happily and usefully whole. So, I'm a great lover of Bill, of his writings. He was a great writer. And I've always been just a bit leery about second-level movements, about AA and, you know, and upward and onward and beyond. So I've always had a little bit of trouble accommodating that. And, you know, the way I look at it, and the way, if she didn't lie to me, I can move this thing. If she lied to me, I'm going to have to talk loud. It's still working? Good. Y'all, I'm too far away from y'all. I feel like I'm in the next county. And I brought my own personal banana, so we have to be here through lunch. But as we go along, by the way, one reason I wanted to get in, I'm not too agile, but I get one of these women to help me get off the stage. I'll bring the mic if anybody, as we go along, I really like for a workshop to be interactive. And so as we go along, if there's anything that you just want to comment about or ask about or elaborate on, whatever, feel free to do that. Just give me a signal and make a deal. I'll just meet you halfway. And then we can do it. If we don't do it that way, it screws up the recording. Nothing worse than questions with no answers, or answers with no questions. So anyway, if we do that, if we go along, and that little thing I read there out of 12 and 12, that's a group. That our program is a group of principles, spiritual in nature. If practice a way of life, will expel that obsession, enable the sufferer to become happy and usefully whole. Tremendous, tremendous promise in that, and I found it to be absolutely true. When I look at the steps, and I'm not going to go through, well, I will go through all of them, but in lumps, and not each one of them. But when I look at the steps, I see them kind of broken down into a category. Like the first three, to me, constitute one category. And it's basically the foundation for recovery. Now, you know, there's nothing mandatory about steps. You know that. You probably know people who've never done steps just like I do. I've known people who lived and sober and died sober and never touched a book. We had an old boy, I was living in Raleigh, had an old guy that, he was a nice enough fella that wasn't a handsome beast at all, but he was a pretty nice guy. And, I don't know if he had a real name. Everybody called him Fish. You know, I don't know why, but he looked like a fish, but part of the reason. And he was a wonderful welcome wagon for the group. He would greet new people coming in and say, "How do you do? I'm Fish." And then he would always manage to work in that, you know, "I've been sober X number of years, and I've never read that book." That was his claim to fame. Talking about the big book. And the newcomer would say, "Something, I guess." "Well, that's wonderful," or whatever. That old Fish looked like he'd never read the book. You know, that boy, that's why he looked like a fish. He was a rough-looking boy. And but that was his greeting to newcomers. You know, he died sober after 20-some years, and he died sober. So it's not mandatory by steps. It's a matter of whether we want to have the freedom that comes from doing the actions, of taking the actions. But for my money, those first three steps are essentially the foundation. You know, where in the first one, I admit to myself that I am beat. I am flat beat. I'm an alcoholic. I'm not a wine sipper. I am an alcoholic. If I take a drink, I cannot predict what I'll do. God only knows. And so that's who I am. I'm a guy who is powerless over alcohol. If I take a drink, I can't predict what I'll do. And if I don't take a drink, I am miserably out of sorts. You know, I have an unmanageable life. I have a life that tends to get into chaos and confusion and anger, distress, and all kind of stuff. So that a drink becomes absolutely mandatory for me. That's who I am. You know, and that's what I need to know. That's very, very important to know that. And then, in the second one, I come to believe there's hope. You know, that, you know, thank God for that step. And I'll just skim it this way. There's a little bit of a movement. I don't know if you guys have run into it here, but you bet I'm going to be laying in front of the tank on this one. It won't matter much. I mean, tanks run over a lot bigger stuff than me. But there's a movement going now that we ought to put more straight-line religious language into the program, rather than God is going to understand him that we ought to get more definitive with that and use traditional religious terms. I'm going to lay down in front of the tank, because had we had traditional religious terms, I would have never come into Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't have been able to pass through a barrier like that. And so every trend is not a good trend, you know. But that's very, very important there, that I've got a hopeless condition. Second one says there's hope. Come to believe in a power that makes sense to me, a power that I'm capable of believing in. Tremendously important that can restore me to sanity. Let me give you one example. Well, I've just listed, this will relate somewhere in there. I'll make sure it relates, whether it fits or not. I'll give you one example of what that looks like in real life. I'll mention the denomination. I was out in Utah a while back, and I was speaking at a prison. And after the meeting, the chairman, the inmate who was the chairman of the group, collared me and he said, "Did you approve LDSAA?" And I said, "Well, number one, I don't approve anything. I'm a member. I don't run anything." And I said, "What is LDSAA?" "Well, it's the Latter-day Saints, the Mormon version of Alcoholics Anonymous." I'd never heard of it. And he's locked up in it, but couldn't even see daylight, but he knew about it, and I didn't. And so he told me, And he said, it's pretty rampant here. He said, we've got it here, that we've got LDS groups, LDSA groups here in the prison and in the community. And I won't go into a whole bunch more. It shows up in a lot of different ways, you know, in that community. I've checked it out, and somebody sent me the material, and I'll tell you why I'm as heavily resistant as I am. The second step in LDSAA says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, just like ours, then it adds, through our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Well, that's a pretty stark departure from God as we understand Him, eh? That makes a very wide door quite narrow, and I don't want to do that, because we come in here damaged people. We come in here people who are scarred in many different ways. And so I want to see that, like these first three steps, be a place where you come in, whatever the baggage, and you're in the right place. And so it's just a kind of thing that comes to that. So, but that's the foundation. The next four, the way I look at them, now you won't find this written anywhere, this is just Tom I stuff, you know, but the next four basically have to do with causes and conditions. You know, what is it that, what's an unmanageable life look like in real terms? And what is it that makes me turn irresistibly to the thought of a drink at the drop of a hat? You know, what is it about me that drives this thing in such a weird kind of way? It causes and conditions. And that's what our inventory process is about, is seeking out those things that drive me, those things that own my mind, those things that absolutely guarantee that I'll drink again. And until I get relief of those conditions, which the rest of the steps will do, I'm sunk. You know? And so causes and conditions. To understand, what am I talking about when I say I'm an alcoholic? What is this thing that drives me so? And starting to understand that through that inventory process. I like to lump the four together, the fourth and fifth, which are so critically important, and then six and seven. You know, inventory doesn't mean much if I don't do some decision-making about, well, what do you want to do about it? And so now I like to keep stuff real simple so I can understand it. And so to me, six simply means you want to do something about it or don't you? You want to get well or don't you? It's decision time. What do you want to do? Key point, you know, if you don't want to do it, you're not going to, you know. And then seven, basically, just asking God to remove those shortcomings, you know. I was always interested in why we use two different terms with shortcomings and what? Well, that's good enough. It's close. Then the shortcomings, you know. And I'd never understood it until I got it in biblical terms. In biblical terms, it refers to sins of omission and sins of commission. Commission's much what I did, you know, those actions that I take. Those are the commission things. And omission's what I failed to do. The minute I looked at it, I understood what was the difference between defects of character. That's the harm I've done, the things I've done, the goofy things I've done. And then shortcomings is what I failed to do. And so what that does is gives me a good handle on what it is I'm dealing with. You know, what is it I'm dealing with? You know, stopping drinking, frankly, is the easiest part of alcoholism. By far, it's the easiest part. That thing of dealing with that disordered life is more than challenging. That is a daunting process. And so that's what the step just guide us through. So you got the foundation, you got the ability to change, the tools to change, and then now I think the answer to the seven step prayer is steps 8 through 9. And where we deal, I'll just throw in this one extra thing. No extra charge for this. This is on the house. In fact, I've circulated it a bit, maybe even to Georgia, but somebody sent me something. I get a lot of junk on the computer, and you probably do too, but I get some jewels every once in a while. Somebody sent me a thing. It was it had a little title on it. It was what it was a guy describing the death of a guy he'd worked with, you know, an alcoholic he'd worked with. And the title of it was "You Don't Have to Drink to Die." And what he's talking about is people. You've seen them if you've been in AA long at all. You've seen them. People. Well, Fish was a good example. Now he survived. He survived miserably for 20 some years. But a lot of people come in and don't deal with those defects, don't deal with that unmanageability, and then wind up drinking after ABC years. Pick it. And a lot of people, an awful lot of suicides occur in recovery. I'm told, and I don't doubt it, that more suicides are committed by alcoholics going through recovery than through active alcoholism. And I believe that. I believe it. Because I think alcohol for me was suicide prevention. It kept me from committing suicide. No question in my mind whatsoever. And so if I don't do those things that deal with those defects of character, I'll be tormented with that forever. I don't care how long I don't drink. But those things are the driving force of alcoholism. To get sober without it is it's a bear, yeah. I've dealt with this far too many times, and I had one. Well, I always have to tell an example, otherwise I don't understand what I'm talking about. I had a guy come in one night. And we chased him around a little bit, but he was just hard to capture. And he came in one night, and I saw him, you know. And so now I'm always on the lookout for fresh meat coming in. So when I saw him come in, I made a beeline over there, and all I was going to do is greet him. He didn't see it that way. So when he saw me coming, he bolted out the door. Well, I didn't want to let him get away, you know. So now you picture, here's a oldest active man in AA in North Carolina. And I'm out here chasing this idiot. Well, there's one idiot chasing another idiot. But I'm chasing him around through the bushes. And I thought, God, I hope nobody put that on television. This is how AA invites people into the program. Oh, my God. Never did catch him. He was fast afoot. But unfortunately, he was one of those. Yeah, he was one of those cases. He was good at running, but he wasn't good at living. And he wound up shooting himself and his family right in front of his family. Not unusual whatsoever. But the difficulties of sobriety without dealing with the things that drive us. People who come in here say, well, there's nothing much to this, just don't drink and go to meetings. That's an invitation to suicide. That's what that is. An invitation to suicide. Because too many people can't get by with some simplistic, put a tourniquet on my neck and everything will be okay. I've been to too many funerals, and I guarantee you that recovery is a tricky terrain, a tricky terrain. And then the last, 10 through 12 are, to me, they're the places where I start moving away. Now, I went through all that just to sort of get to this point, because I knew somebody in here had a heart. Thank you very much. God, I never could do anything without drinking. That's great. I appreciate that. But that whole lead up to me, I wanted to give just a little bit of background so I didn't just sound like I'm snapping at Bill. But if we look at the progression of the steps, you know where we're getting the drinking stopped, and then we're starting to deal with the pain and the stuff that drags us in, get started looking so we can meet the world and look folks in the eye instead of hanging our heads. You know, those are important things. And then an interesting thing happens, and I may have to borrow another book, I don't know, but my memory has gotten worse. But interesting to me, if you look at that process of amends, and then look at what follows it, eh? Yeah, when you get through with 8 and 9, we move into the promises. And they're wonderful sounding things, you know, like we're going to win the lottery every Tuesday. A lot of unbelievable things, you know, that are laid out in those promises. And they're very real. They're very real. Those are things that tend to happen if we're paying. Well, there's a caveat, you know, that says if we are painstaking about this phase of our recovery, they're talking about the amends process. We don't just go to heaven based on we get number 10, so here we go. It's a product, you know, and when I start to make those amends, I start to experience what freedom is about. In that meeting that I was with Bill in Toronto, he was talking about traditions, but he talked about how valuable it was to make amends. I don't know how he worked that in, but he did. And he said, and I was 8 years sober when I was meeting, when I met him. And he said, there will come a time, you know, if you do what the steps lead, there'll come a time when you will be able to walk the streets of any city on earth and meet any person you see and look them in the eye. Well, I might have been up to knees by about that time. You know, I wasn't up to eyes. But what a great promise. They talk about freedom, that I have nobody to hide from, and nobody that I had to duck around in a dodge and hope I didn't see you. You know, I'm a free man, and that's the product of that thing. And then those promises outline, you know, what'll happen. You know, what'll happen, and there's unbelievable promises. But I found it to be absolutely true. And then the thing that I want to really, really focus on is, so where do we go from there? We've got all of these promises. We've done all of this focused attention on trying to deal with the problems that drive us, and we're at the point where we become free. And I think you folks are probably familiar enough with steps. I don't need to get a book and start reading at you. But 10 is an awfully important. I will tell you to see a book. I don't know if I got enough nerve to hold a pink book or not. No, I know I'm a male. Can you find step 10 in there? Good. I'm not a very dependent fella, but I am married. And that's right. What this thing's going to say in 10 is talking about, now this is just my take on it, but I think it's pretty well documented in here, too. Can I borrow your glasses? No. No, I'm not going to freeload that much. I got some back here somewhere. There's a thing that we threw with this stuff, you know, and it says these is extravagant promise, think not, you know, and this kind of thing. By the way, you know, we were talking a little bit about some of the chanting and feedback stuff we started getting in AA and tap dancing, all kinds of, I don't know. We don't know how to say amen anymore. We've got to go into some spiel about it. And in my group, at the end of the promises, says, are these extravagant promises? Well, we had the Hallelujah Chorus would say, we think not. Well, we didn't want to just be dictatorial and say, quit doing that stupid stuff. So we just tore it off the bottom book. People get up and read how it works. And read. We'd say, not there. Well, it beat having a big debate, you know, so we got her done anyway. So having gone through it and having to see that we are actually reaping some real rewards, this brings us to step 10. suggest we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. So we continue to keep looking at ourselves, take a look at where we're goofing and this kind of stuff, deal with it quickly. Don't let it get old, die of old age. And do that as we go along. We vigorously commenced this way of living as we cleaned up the past. We have, she highlighted it so much I can't read. We have entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function, all right, we've entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. Now, I want to kind of underline that a little bit. You know, it's just not been growing in insight and personality or this thing. In insight and understanding, we start understanding and effectiveness. Now, what does that mean? And I don't think it's been studying my psyche more. You know, I think, you know, we've done a gracious plenty of that. May go back. But we want to grow in understanding and effectiveness. You know, an interesting thing happens to me when you finish the promises. Now, this is Tom Eyes' rendition of the book. But I think from the time we get through with the part we tore off, everything, nothing focuses on me. Everything focuses on others. Everything in there. And I don't think that means insight and understanding when it says understanding and effectiveness. I don't think that's what it means. It means we have taken care of our dilemma. We've started to reap the rewards. So now what do we do? Look for a bigger hamburger or something? Yeah, what do we do now? And then the rest of step 10 does that. We call that an inventory step. We continue to take inventory. And when something happens wrong, we deal with it all at once. But I really like the way that we approach it in the book. That what we're trying to do is grow in understanding and effectiveness. Let me give you an example of what that means to me. And I hope that you can lace this in to what we're talking about in this whole idea of this the new dimension. That, because I think we very definitely shift from the ninth step on, we shift in to focus on others. Where we quit studying me and start trying to see how I can be an effective instrument in this thing. And so, insight and understanding and effectiveness. Like, I've been troubled for a lot of years over the enormously high failure rate of people coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we started, you know, once treatment emerged, we started just getting avalanches of new members coming in. And I swear to God, I think we had avalanches of at least as many, if not more, going out. And so it just became almost like a revolving scene that we were seeing. Well, that's troubling to me because I've seen very few people come to AA by accident. I've seen very few that were overdiagnosed. You know, most people I've seen come to AA were late, not early. And so I don't like to rush to judgment on that too quick. So if people are not coming in and staying, I want to understand that the best I can. Now, I'm no shrink, but I'm no idiot either. And I can take a look and listen to people and try to pick up on why is it that people with a killer illness can have a solution in hand and turn around and walk off. Something wrong with that picture. Something wrong. And so, I mean, it'd be easy to demonize the person and say, well, he just was phony and he did, was no good or anything. No, I don't want to write it off that cheap. No, I want to look at my piece of the action. You know, when that person walked in, except for that guy that outran me in the bushes, he was in my lair. He was in my lair. And so I'd rather than looking at what's wrong with him, I'd rather look at why was it he left? You know, why was it he couldn't see the vision or see the hope that was here? And so, you know, that was deeply troubling to me. And I wanted to do something about it if I could. I'm one guy, but by golly, I'm one. I am certainly one. And so I started thinking about that. and listening to what people did that they thought was effective. And the front row's open. We're glad you got here. In the nick of time, man, we were going down. I never embarrass anybody. Yeah, but I kept looking at that, you know, and trying to feel. And so I got a feel. This was back when folks first started doing a lot of this intensive work in the book, you know, where they would take people through the book and make them learn it in Farsi and everything else. But we really, really made a science out of that thing of going through the book. And by golly, it seemed to be having some effect. And one day I was at a conference somewhere in another state, and an old buddy of mine told me he was doing that and had good, real good experience with it, that people were actually staying sober. I said, now I'm a visual guy. You know, I mean, I understand the language, but I see it better if I can see an example of what we're doing. So I said, show me what you do. And so we're in a hotel corridor in a hall, in a hotel. So we just got some chairs. And we made a little circle of chairs, and we just captured some alcoholics coming down the hall. Said, sit out. Sit out here. We want. So we sat out, and all he did was just open the book and read some. And then he'd read that one little piece, and he'd say, does anybody identify or relate to that? Identify means you've done it. Relate means you would have if you'd have thought of it. And that was his criteria. You know, so, and I looked, I said, well, by golly, that makes sense. I mean, that just plain makes sense. And I thought, well, my God, I can do that. I mean, good God, anybody can read and say you identify, relate. So I went back and just got the word out to a few people around that we were going to do a big book workshop, not a study or a discussion, a workshop, work underlined. You do what's there. And so we started out. We finished with almost as many as we started with. We finished with 15 people. And now that's long term. This is not a weekend study. This is a going through 164 pages and doing every action that's laid out. And I didn't think we're ever going to get through. In that model, the leader does all the reading. I got tired of reading, my God. But the leader does all the reading and leads the meeting. Now, and it's not a speak up. You know, it'd be just, do you identify or relate with that? And if so, how? You know, and then every meeting would be like that. And it was a phenomenal thing. You know, like I had started to work. I had a woman come in. She's a wonderful friend of mine, but we were not cozy companions when at that point she came in that group. She was a arrogant bitch of a woman. I mean, she was just, she's from New England, and that's not a sin, but if you're, now, wait, you're not from New England, are you? Catch her. But she came in. You know, I thought her mission in AA was to just aggravate me. All she wanted to do was argue, debate God or whatever. And I thought, boy, oh boy. But it's open door. I mean, I can't pick and choose. I mean, she walked in, and I said, oh, God, here we go. A year into debating society. And she settled down and was true to form for a little while. But it's interesting how people do. You know, people are really interesting. They group. Now, I don't mean to put anybody, make anybody uncomfortable. We tend to group with folks with whom we are simpatico, eh? We got. Well, she got back on the back row with two other aggravated cases. And so there they sat. That's like the Three Stooges, you know. We're going through it. Of course, I'm watching them.
You know, I'm watching for the explosion to come. And amazing thing. They all three started to soften up a bit. The other two first. But they started leaning in instead of out. You know, amazing thing. And now I'm a great believer in spontaneity. I just love to just do stuff right off the cuff. I particularly like spontaneity if it's well planned. And what I mean is that we spontaneously one night wound up on the third step prayer. Just spontaneously, no plan. Well, maybe a little plan. And so I said, all right, we're at the third step prayer. Going to give you three options. One, you can get out and do it with us, or you can hold our hands while we do it, or you can step back and watch us do it. She told me later, and I won't even begin to tell you what she said to herself, but she told me later that she called me stuff I'd never been called in a bar room. But the amazing thing, she stepped in. She stepped in, not out. That was no big surprise. That was a changing moment. And if anybody had told me this would have happened, there is no way. Good trip? It was a good trip. Okay. You bad girl. it was a turning point, and if I would have never believed it, she became my backup. If I had to be gone, she led the group. I would have trusted her with the coffee pot before. But sure enough, she's sober today. And that's been many years. As a matter of fact, 15 out of 15 are sober today. And that's not the norm figure. But I mean, and it doesn't mean there's a magic potion, but it does mean we don't need some new approach to the work that we do with each other. It's fundamental, you know, it's fundamental kind of stuff. And so that was an amazing thing. I've done a bunch of those things since. It's the most effective work I've ever done. So understanding. You know, understanding and effectiveness. I don't think that means do more inventory. I don't think that's what it means at all. I don't even think it hints at that. It means how can I be understanding? How can I understand the problem and be effective? And so, you know, if I see somebody isolating in a corner, I'm not going to go over and give them the bum's rush, but I'm going to watch a little bit and try to get some understanding about why is that so. And then, you know, just. Most people are amenable to just being messed with a little bit. And so usually, I mean, you got to gauge it somewhat. You know, that we had a guy come in the group one night. He's one of those guys. He never had belonged to a group. He just sort of floated. He was like a hummingbird. He'd go around and suck a little sap here and there. And that's what he was. He just wandered around from meeting to meeting. And he, a miserable guy. The night he walked into our group, that he was just a miserable, lost-looking guy. And now, I didn't want to mess with him too much. And I was trying to figure out how to do it without being injurious, because if you crash in wrong without understanding what you're dealing with, you can do a lot of harm. And so I just went over and I offered to buy him a cup of free coffee. And he readily accepted. And I just kind of went with the group, just goosed him a little. But not much. I mean, you know, he couldn't stand a lot of heavy-duty stuff. You know, that I didn't jump on her until I read she was a fine person and would not attack a male. I could tell that. But you got to know who you're dealing with. And she, what? You're not her. I don't know about her now. I'm afraid my wife might get the recording or something. But that guy, it's amazing how people respond, eh? Now, if I'd have gone over there and just shook him up, and God knows, man, why don't you settle down and get you a home group or something like that, I'd have run him off. But I just sort of goosed him a little bit there and gave him a free coffee. And he started following me. It was just like a puppy. You know, I mean, he had never sat on the front row in his life. Now I'm a front row person. Not because I'm dedicated. I just can't hear. That's why I got those doorbells in my ears. Y'all sound funny. I just got these stupid things. But he'd follow me around. Yeah, he sat on the front row. And, well, anyway, there's always a whole lot more to a story if you just listen. So we started hanging out. He said, I'd like to get involved in something. And I said, well, go to prison with me. I'd be going every Wednesday. I'd go over there. He said, go with me. He said, really? I can go? Yeah, you can go. We'll even get you out. And he took me. He liked that part. Yeah. And so he came over. Now, he's a deep pockets guy. This guy's got, he is deep pockets. Just look at that. He's something. I was driving one of those little old Hondas that looked like they put a chopping block on it. They cut it off. And it looked like they didn't finish it. You know, they got the... Well, anyway, it's not a handsome car. So he came to my house in a big log Mercedes. And I said, let's go with my car. And he said, do we have to? I said, all right, I'll cater to you then. So we drive up to that big log Mercedes, go into meeting. And just understanding and effectiveness is what we're talking about, in case you forgot. We go in, and we're having a meeting. The correctional officer comes in and taps me on the shoulder and says, Tom, do you have a Mercedes? And I said, yeah, but... And he said, well, the light's on. And I said, no, it's not mine. Mine's in the garage on some blocks. I can't get it to run. he said, no, not that one. He said, this is a big one. And so I said, it's his. So the guy told him, said... You left your lights on. You need to go turn them off. And the officer went out. And I said, go turn the lights off. He said, no. I said, come on, man. You can't let... Well, we're arguing in front of... We're supposed to be conducting a meeting. And we're having a battle. And I said, go and do it out. He said, I don't want to leave the meeting. Now, this is the same guy that had been floating around sucking sap, eh? He don't want to leave the meeting. I said, I don't want to walk home. We had inmates refereeing the fight, you know. And so finally he said, I've got a good battery. I said, well, if you don't, you better know the number for AAA. But anyway, we finished it. But that same guy. And then I just tell you one little increment of that, just what understanding and effectiveness mean. It means don't just pat them on the back and say good night. You know, I mean, listen a little bit. Tell me what's happening here. And so that is that's what happened. You know, he got his nerve up. He started. I noticed that the guy cried. You could read the steps and he'd cry. The only time I cry is if you read the concepts, you know, then I cry. But he would cry at anything. You know, I said, man, there's more to this story. But I didn't want to pry, you know, so one night he started telling me. This is more than an interesting guy. This was a real case of alcoholism. This is a guy from the other part of the country, and he'd had a previous marriage, had two sons. One of them had committed suicide. Didn't know that. Excuse me. And another one, 42 years old, with grandchildren he'd never seen. Well, you can well imagine the picture started to emerge pretty quickly. And so I saw why he'd tear up every time he looked around. And I was getting ready to kiss you, and then you take it and sit down.
Oh, you have one.
No, thank you. No, I'm good, thank you. Yeah, so, but we talked about that a little bit. And he said, will you help me with that? I said, well, I'll try. And so I was just very gentle in my helping. I thought about it a little bit, and I said, and I tell you what I want you to do. Was his son lived on the other side of the country. I said, what I'm going to tell you to do is buy a ticket to that town, going out one day, coming back the next. Don't barbecue something. Don't go hunt a moose or anything like that. Just go out there to see that boy. Tell him you want 2 hours of his time. Excuse me. Then you make direct amends to that guy. Yeah, okay. Now, he argued about it a little bit, but he said, yeah, I see what you mean. I'll do it. Then he finally got him on the plane. God knows, I never thought we'd get him on there. And he got out there to that state, called me back, and he said, I'm coming back. And I could tell the way he said it, it didn't mean mission accomplished. And I said, why are you coming back? He said, he doesn't want to see me. I said, how do you know that? He said, well, I just know that. I said, oh, no. No, no, not going to work. You pick up that phone, call that fellow, you tell him you want 2 hours of his time, and he'll do it. And if you don't do that, don't come back to North Carolina. You can go somewhere, but don't come back here. And so he did. And the predictable happened. That's what amends are about. And so family reunited. That summer, that family came and spent the entire vacation with the grandpa. Of course, typical. I chastised him, but it was after the fact. He bought one of them a new car for the first thing. I said, way to go, big guy. Anyway, you know, that thing of understanding and effectiveness, you know, that you got to understand before you start and just bleeping to somebody about what you do. That's one dimensional. But understanding who the person is and how to approach and this kind of thing so that you don't walk in doing damage instead of being helpful. You know, so it pays to just listen to people a little bit. And to me, that's what 10 Steps is about. Well, it's what the book says, so it's got to be true. The other thing I like in that, I said it before, but let me say it one more time. Once you leave those promises, everything following that is about others. It starts with me, but it never ends there. It never ends there. We take the actions to take care of the things we encounter. It's not about me. It's about trying to get reunited with this world and trying to straighten out that wreckage of the past and start trying to live in good rapport with the folk around us. And, you know, I love the way that next part in there talks about, you know, what we get restored to is just the life. You know, we don't become superhuman just because we recover. We get restored to life. And just like any other human being, we're going to goof sometimes. I mean, that's just human. But that doesn't mean it's the end of the world. You know, I don't need to see Sigmund Freud because I've made a goof. You know, I don't need that. And I don't need deep therapy or anything like that. That's human. To err is human. But what the book says, and I think it's excellent guidance, is don't make a big deal out of it. You know, if you goof, say, hey, I'm sorry about that. Sorry about that. I'll try not to do that again. That's all. I mean, it's not to require the Pan Mujan conference or anything. You just hit it and go. And most things are that way. Yeah. So that whole business of getting back into doing another inventory and all this kind of thing, I don't think that's what's intended here. What's there is just sort of keeping stock of what we're doing, and if we screw something up, take care of it immediately. We do that, and then we resolutely turn our attention to someone we can help. We don't dwell on that forever, make a federal case out of it. You know, we move on and try to look at how we can be of service. And so to me, this is a tremendously valuable part of our program. And it's part of the reason that I'm not too eager to develop some new spaceship to a different dimension. You know, those principles are still extremely important. They haven't changed, not a lick. They're the same principle.
and trying to find a different language to describe it, you know, it's laid out very well, you know. And so it's just a matter of I think, exploring these things to the depth. And so, yeah, if some other kind of language or terminology, it's fine. I mean, we're all growing. You can do it any way you want to, of course. But I'm just saying that before we start thinking we've got to have a new set of tools, it's very important to see that we're using the ones we've got very well. Then we can add if we need to, but I don't want to just jump on every new thing that comes along. And of course, that's not real new, but what's in here is awfully new. Let me give you another example. And I think bottom line of what I'd be trying to get at here today. How are we doing on time, by the way? Boss man? 10:30. Does that mean the bell goes off? We got to eat. They got us outnumbered. We better quit when the time comes. Well, we'll go a little bit longer, and I think you kind of caught my drift now. That so many times we'll look for some new esoteric way of dealing with stuff, and the fundamental principles are powerful things, and it doesn't matter to me how you about. Language, terminology, all that kind of stuff, as long as we don't get away from the fundamental things that are just basic to this whole program. Is that somebody's? you're one of the absolute no-nos in a prison is having a cell phone. And I was in there the other night, and I was having at it with some guys. A phone went off. And I said, all right, whose is it? Whose is it? The guy said, it's yours. I said, shut up. It was me. Oh, my God. That alone, that'll make you up. But not for very long. But that, tell you what, just to broaden this a little bit. Because I think if rather than having an atmosphere of thou shalt not, you know, I'd really like to invite you to explore some different, not different vistas, but deeper vistas, you know, in terms of, just like what I talked about, that was what a wonderful thing that was for me, just starting to do that big book thing. And I'll tell you just a couple others and hope that maybe it'll stimulate some thinking. You know, I don't mind telling you, we're losing ground in a lot of ways in Alcoholics Anonymous. We are losing ground. We're losing grounds dramatically in terms of three legacy groups. You know, we're moving more and more to one-dimensional groups that are recovery only. And that is a very, very skinny leg to stand on. Yeah. And it shuts out all of the rewarding things that come from unity of service, of being mindful of the folks around it. And so in that interest, you know, I'd like to get you to think with me just a little bit about a little broader extension of that, how you could have to be have understanding and effectiveness. I won't flesh it out anymore. If anybody wants to talk about it privately, I'll be glad to get with you and pursue it any. But they, I'm a guy Jeremy and I were talking some about this, that people get into AA 1,000 different ways. Very few have ever come just because it was a good idea. You know, most people have got some dragon snapping at them, you know, that usually sometimes often married to them or work for them. But anyway, there's very few of us just say, geez, I think I'll go to AA and straighten out my life. You know, most of us come here under some duress of no matter whatever. And more over the years, we've moved dramatically in a different direction. And now, I won't flesh it out, but I'd be glad to talk to anybody who wants to talk about it. Way back when I came in, 12th step calls were the order of the day. You know, I had three last year. I've had that many at one time, way back. And what was so important about a 12-step call? when an alcoholic reached out to another alcoholic, it created a bond of loyalty second to none. That person who received the 12-step call would not hesitate one second to do that for somebody else. So it created a powerful bond among members, this thing of how we come in. Now, it seems that we really function on the basis of social referrals. You know, we've got social referrals from all kinds of places. You have courts or driving classes or whatever, you know, but we got people get sort of led to AA by some agent. I would bet, and this is probably a little above average crowd, you know, turning out for a deal like this, Marietta, I would bet that 75% of this crowd has never participated in a 12-step call as provider or consumer. It's almost a lost art. You know, it's just something that's just almost relic of the past. It still happens a little bit, but very little, very little. And so that powerful loyalty that was generated there evaporates, you know, if you don't invigorate it, if you don't replenish it. And so we've had a lot of stuff like that. One of the things that used to bug me enormously, well, it still would, but we found a way to deal with it, was people being mandated into Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, people coming in with little slips of paper and wanting somebody to sign them. I never would sign them. And it wasn't because I didn't like the person, it's because I did. But I wouldn't sign them, and I never knew why. I just wouldn't. You know, I would wimp out. You know, if they'd ask me to sign, I'd say, no, she'll take care of that. She's got a brand new pen. She'll be glad to do it. I'd just wimp out. And I never embarrassed a single person with that piece of paper. I always figured they're embarrassed enough already. They don't need me to add to it. And so I just sort of slough it off to somebody. And one day I started thinking about that. Why won't I do that? And I really didn't know. But we decided in our group to see if we couldn't do something about it. And I mentioned in our correction committee one night in the group. I said, how would you guys like to tackle that court slip business? And what guy sponsored, 47-year guy, said, oh, hell, Tom, we can't do anything about that. They do it all over the world. I said, well, let's don't tackle the world. Let's just start right here in Mayberry. And he says, well, we could try, but it won't work. So man will never fly. So we decided to try. And we contacted the probation manager for that part of the state. Didn't go to a judge, because we were going to keep the judge for an ace in the hole. I knew we could deal with him. But I wanted the people who were doing the work to do the contact. So we set up an appointment with that guy. And I was flying somewhere. And I do my best writing when I'm way up there and the phone doesn't ring and God's right next door. So I can write up a storm. So I said, why is it I hate that so much? And I wrote it out. I think I wrote 26 things that were dead wrong about it. And then with as much generosity as I could muster, I wrote 10 things that I thought would be pluses, all for the probation officer, none for the guy. Well, that told me. So when we met with that guy, the sixth item of the 26 said, it told me why I didn't sign paper. It said, if I sign the paper, it makes me something other than what I want to be to another alcoholic. All I want to be is another alcoholic. I don't want to be a validator or a checker or a supervisor or a junior probation officer. That's what I'd be. And so I understood it. And so when we went in, we met with the guy, couldn't have been better. The one I just cited is the one that absolutely blew his mind. He said, I never thought of that. I said, me either. But right there next to God, he told me to tell you this. we were home free. And that's 14 years ago. We haven't seen a piece of paper since. So these are not impossible systems. All it requires is understanding and effectiveness. You know, the way I look at it, if you're going to criticize what somebody's doing, you got to offer something better. And so we offered four alternatives that we thought were better. He picked the one he thought was best, and that's what we do. So it's simple when you get down to it. What's not simple is wanting to throw rocks or write letters to the editor or call the president or something like that. You know, it's just a matter that you got two people trying to do the same thing. You know, they're both trying to get a guy back on his feet or gal. And so we're trying to do the same thing. We're just trying to figure out how we can cooperate. That's what cooperation with the professional community means, is how can we work together for a good end. And so all of this, to me, comes out of this 10th step. And one thing I guarantee you, it'll keep you awfully busy. It'll keep you awfully busy. And that ain't a bad deal. I tell you that. It's not a bad deal. I'm going to wind up. I'm nowhere near finished, but I'm going to quit anyway. One thing I want to just sort of wind up on. One of the things that if you read that thing I was citing there, that I had my little book that's in that Language of the Heart. Great, that's a great collection of Bill's articles. And one he wrote on this subject was in there. And one of the things he was talking about was how you deal with this kind of, what do you call it? Darn it, it starts with a D. The thing of feeling sort of victimized in what you're doing. See, like you're overwhelmed stuff. That's not the words he's using. I'll think of it in a minute, though. But what he's talking about is this kind of feeling of being overwhelmed and all this kind of stuff. And I'll pull his stuff up in just a second, but I'll give you mine right now. That an awful lot of people balance. So he's talking about this need to restore balance and all this kind of thing. Most people that have talked to me about balance, what they're really asking me is how they can quit doing something. That's really what the agenda is. And you call it whatever you want to. Balance, tell you what my belief is, and that's all it is, one man's belief, is if I follow the principles laid out in this program, yeah, and use those in all of my affairs, I'm going to do very little damage. I also have to bear in mind that everything that I'm committed to in this world is based on principles. My marriage is based on principles. We're coming up, we'll be 43 years this year, and we're getting along pretty decent. That girl's coming along. She's going to make a good wife here one of these days. And it's real good stuff. There are principles involved in that. You know, like I travel all the time, and she doesn't love for me to travel. But she believes in what I'm doing. And so we talk about that. And, this could be a huge problem in our lives, but we make it a point to keep good communication about that. She knows how to work my calendar, and she overworks it sometimes. But it's all right. My employer, my work, has principles that they operate by. I don't have a right to carry out my holy mission in AA at the expense of the principles of my work. I have to do that. I don't have to worry about balance and some sort of way of getting a mystical hold on balance. What I have to do is practice the principles in all my affairs, all of the principles, so that I don't violate one set to accommodate another set. And so I think it's what this is telling us in this part of it, in that I like to put 10 through 12 together because they're the action steps. Some people call them maintenance steps. Those are action steps. Every bit of it is about asking my higher power what I can do. And it's about service. It's about work. It's about doing things. And so that I don't have to strain with things like balance. You know, what I have to do is look, base it on principles. And if I base it on principles, I won't go wrong. If I base it on feelings and attitude and stuff like that, it'll go left field in a minute. Yeah. So that's the way I like to go at that kind of thing. Now, if this, you call this emotional recovery, emotional sobriety, or whatever. What I believe is that if I practice these principles and carry out this program, I don't have to worry about a new way of approaching this. Because the reason I took the time to go through this, I believe that's exactly what this produces if we carry it out.
But just sitting and studying it and reading about it and learning how to pronounce it in four languages doesn't do much. But it's when we put it into motion. And it may not look very serene, but I tell you, it's a heck of a good way to live. Right now I'm in my 54th year. And I am as active today as I have ever been in my life. Just as active. And I don't want to change that. Because I tell you one thing, I am a man truly blessed. And I'm a man for whom this thing has worked in every area of my life. So, anyway, great meeting with you. And if anybody wants to follow up on any of that stuff, that's what I'm here for. I mean, they pay me well here. They're going to double my salary. Two times nothing is nothing. But feel free, if you want to pursue any of that, I'll be glad to talk with you. Okay. Thanks a lot. Thank you, folks. Thank you. Good job. Thanks a lot.